April 19th, 1982, and I'm talking to Senator Robert Ziegler. I'd like to start out with where you were born and your early schooling.
All righty. Well, I was born in Baltimore, Maryland on March 27th, 1921. There's a reason for having been born in Baltimore, Maryland, and that goes back to the fact that in the early 1920s, hospital facilities in the then territory were very, very primitive. And the genteel ladies, when they found out that they were with child, they would get on a steamer, and then they would go to Seattle, and then take a train, and go to wherever their mothers were for the accouchement. So I've always maintained stoutly that I was conceived in Alaska, born in Baltimore, and returned to Alaska when I was 6 weeks old.
In Ketchikan, Alaska?
In Ketchikan, right.
And did you go to school in Ketchikan?
Yes, up through the fifth or the sixth grade. I frankly don't remember which one. I believe it was the fifth, though it could have been the sixth. And then my parents separated. And I spent a lot of time in a lot of different schools, primarily in the Baltimore area.
Mm-hmm. Until what age?
I think when I was about 12 or 13, perhaps even 11, I was sent to a marvelous Episcopal boarding school by the name of St. James, which was near Hagerstown, Maryland. And I almost managed to graduate from St. James, but I got kicked out for smoking too much at the wrong time in the wrong place. And I finished out my junior year at Annapolis High School, and then for my senior year I went to a military prep school called Charlotte Hall Military Academy down in Southern Maryland. Graduated cum laude, and then I matriculated at the University of Virginia in 1939. And what with pre-law and law, and World War II, during which I made democracy safe for the world for the second time, I finally managed to get a law degree in 1948, and I couldn't wait to get back to Alaska.
Why did you decide to go into law?
Well, I have a fairly good flair, I'm told, for speaking and writing the English language. My father was an attorney before me, and I wanted to get back to Alaska, and I couldn't think of a job as well paying as the practice of law, especially for a young punk just out of law school. And I remember shopping around in Baltimore, and I think the best possible deal that could be found was starting to clerk for any of the major firms at $100 a month, which is true. And my father knew how avid I was to get back, and so he made a real deal for me. I got room and board and $300 a month, so how can you turn down a deal like this?
How familiar were you with your father's practice before you actually started practicing?
Not real familiar. Of course, you know, back in those days, you knew everybody in town, and you knew generally who the clientele consisted of. My kind of people, my kind of town. I never have been happy away from Alaska, so. And it was certainly a general practice office. You know, no question about that. You did a little bit of everything. You could not afford to be a specialist.
What kind of major business was in Ketchikan at the time?
Well, it's always been a fishing town. They used to have a sign up saying Ketchikan was the king salmon capital of the world. We had logging camps and a sawmill. And we were more or less a trading center for the villages in the area. Almost everything that came in destined for Prince of Wales Island or some of the smaller communities in the area was funneled through Ketchikan. Salmon would have been the king, though, in those days.
Mm-hmm.
No pun intended, I hasten to add.
When you went to practice with your father, what did you do, and who was there?
Well, my father and Walter B. King, who is has been deceased for many, many years, had a good two-man shop. They were industrious. They were well-respected. And what I did was I would do anything that they asked me to do. And that could have arranged from a divorce to a real estate contract to a criminal case. It was a little bit of everything.
Did you take the bar right away?
Mm-hmm. I graduated from Virginia in, I think, the second week of October. Drove across the country in 5 days. Put myself in the car on a boat, arrived in Ketchikan, and took the bar within a week.
So you didn't have to have any residency period?
I was a resident. I claimed Alaskan residency at all times, right, no matter where I was.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
What was the bar exam like?
It was pretty grueling. We had 3 days of it, as I recollect. And I'm not a typist, and my handwriting is atrocious. But in those days, they had 3 graders, and for the life of me, I couldn't tell you where they were, but the idea was your exam would be sent to Anchorage, where the one attorney would grade, and then it would be sent to Fairbanks for the second grader to review and grade, and then down to Juneau. So you had a build-in delay of about, as recollection serves me, it was at least 3 months before I heard that I had passed it.
Mm-hmm. You weren't sent any letters saying that you'd passed the bar?
I don't know. I think the U.S. District Court judge or the clerk called me and said they'd been notified that I had passed. And when I come down and take the oath, and of course we had a big celebration.
Did you have to be examined by a judge? Were you?
We had an oral examination, which was in addition to the written part. There was an oral exam, mm-hmm. which was administered by one of the members of the Ketchikan Bar, in this case, Bob Turnberry. And this was an open court, and all the hacking and wheezing civics students in Ketchikan from General High School were there. And Ketchikan High School, no general. And the questions were duck soup, but you went through the drill.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you were admitted to the bar, and you received a certificate saying that it was okay to turn you loose in an unsuspecting populace. And that's what happened.
Who was admitted with you?
I believe I was sui generis at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I have no recollection of anybody else being present.
Want to tell me a little bit about your father's practice before you were there?
Oh, he was a great trial lawyer. A great trial lawyer. And you should read over the memoranda that he dictated a year or so prior to his death.
Is that what Catherine Ziegler has, is that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were there any particular stories that he would tell you about his early practice?
Oh, yes, many. Many. He, you won a couple of them. Of course, rum running or bootlegging used to be a lucrative means of livelihood, and it wasn't too far from Prince Rupert. And Dad tells a story, or told the story, about how he got a call around 2 o'clock in the morning from one of his clients who had a seine boat and had run over to Prince Rupert, and customs or the revenuers had been lying in wait for this guy because he made this trip quite frequently, and he came back and the revenuers boarded his vessel, and they didn't find any contraband at all. And so the skipper called my father and came down, and there they were. They were sitting around in the gallery of the boat, and the skipper was righteously indignant. And father, trying to earn his fee, started to give the federal guys a terrible going over, like, here's my innocent client, and accused of wrongdoing, no warrant, and here you are on his boat searching the same again with no warrant. And he was reading the right act, and in the course of emoting, he got totally carried away, and he flung out his arm and happened to hit a pair of old rubber boots that were hanging. And of course, they were full of booze bottles. And as he flung out his arm, where the bottles broke, so at least a couple of them. And father said, I've learned to keep myself under control, even when pleading a righteous cause.
Do you remember any other ones? I just want to put that on your it claps right on.
Yeah, I know.
Do you remember any other stories of the prayer?
Oh, yeah. There was an old-timer, and you heard his name, I'm sure. He finished out his days in Anchorage, a guy by the name of George Grigsby. Mm-hmm. Just a fabulous character. And father tells a story about Johnny Starkloff, who was accused of robbing a trap, fish piracy, in other words. And the prosecution only had a circumstantial case, and it was predicated primarily upon the fact that in that portion of the trap from which the fish had been brailed on a dark and stormy night, they found an old-time hat had fallen in the barrel, and there it was. And so Grigsby knew that the prosecution was going to connect Starkloff, who had a notorious reputation for being a fish pirate. They were going to work the hat in, and tie it with Starkloff, and hopefully get a conviction. And Grigsby was no dummy. He knew it was coming because the hat had been sitting on the prosecutor's table for all kinds of time. And so they took the noon break, and George went down to Thompson and Hattrick, which was the men's emporium in those days, and bought an identical hat. And it was the biggest goddamn hat he could find. And he went back up before the lunch hour was over and substituted hats. And so later on, when Starkloff took the stand, he was asked if this hat on the prosecutor's table was his hat. And Starkloff said, no, absolutely not. He said, I've never had a hat like that in my life. And the prosecutor said, well, would you mind trying this hat on for the jury just to see how it fits for size? And sure enough, Johnny put the hat on and it came right down to his shoulders. It went totally, totally over his head. And so they laughed the case out of court. Of course, you get disbarred, obviously, for doing that sort of thing nowadays. But it was successful in those days.
Are there other cases that the ethics weren't quite the same as we've used today?
No, well, we've done away now with the element of surprise in civil and criminal cases. But in those days, if you could run in a mysterious last-minute witness, why, you know, so much the better for your side. Mm-hmm. And you might say they practice law in the early days of the state in a more unregimented way than we do it now. Or unregimented, I guess, would be the word.
Did it make a difference?
Well, I don't know whether it made a difference or not. Law was more of a personal thing in those days. It's kind of impersonal now, I suppose. But everybody in town knew everybody else, and nobody was really red hot for the idea of prohibition. Mm-hmm. And it was very difficult to convict a bootlegger. I mean, you had to have an ironclad case. And the prosecution very seldom did.
Who was the prosecution?
I can't speak for all those prosecutors who served before I got there, but when I got there, There's a gentleman by the name of Patrick Gilmore, Jr., whose dad used to be U.S. magistrate, and very kindly old gentleman, and very sagacious, although he wasn't trained. He understood human beings as well as some of us understood law, and although he may have used devious routes to get there, he often, more often than not, he ended up with the right conclusion, irrespective of his lack of legal background.
He was devious in his cases?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying although he was not a man of the law, his common sense was so great that he inevitably or invariably ended up with the right conclusion, not devious at all.
Mm-hmm.
He just knew a lot about human nature.
Was he the only prosecutor in the area? Did they just have one?
No, I'm talking about his father, Judge Patrick Gilmore Sr. and Patrick Gilmore Jr. Patrick Gilmore Jr. was the prosecutor when I returned from law school.
Mm-hmm.
His dad was serving then as a U.S. commissioner. Two separate and distinct individuals. Pat Jr. was a ruthless prosecutor. Very, very tough indeed. And then he ran across some contretemps when in Ketchikan have the big cleanup. We closed down our famous red light district because some of the blue noses in town had decided apparently it'd be better to have the prostitutes all over town instead of one controlled, supervised area, which was our red light district. And Judge Fulta, who died, I believe, in 1955, was a very tough judge. And he summarily removed Pat Jr. from having anything to do with the grand jury, who was looking into the conditions of sin in Ketchikan. And thereafter, Pat left the office of the district attorney with alacrity and went into private practice.
When was his father the magistrate or the commissioner?
At all times during the time I came back in 1948 for several years. I would guess that he lasted for about 5 or 6 years.
So his son practiced in front of him?
I think so. If my chronology is straight, yeah. But I don't think that phased either one of them, really, I don't.
Are any of the Gilmores alive? Are there any?
Pat Jr. is alive in Ketchikan. He still has his shingle out, but he is not active. And mostly he watches his investments. I haven't seen him in court for years.
Mm-hmm.
A very suave individual, very well educated, and extremely articulate. I think a great deal of the heart went out of him when he had this fiasco with the grand jury and the reformation of the mores of Ketchikan.
Why?
Well, because a man with undoubted ability to be read the riot act by a U.S. District Court judge for either nonfeasance or malfeasance and being summarily dismissed from having anything to do with the grand jury, which was looking into sin in Ketchikan, would have to be a terrible blow to one's ego. But better you should talk to Pat Gilmore himself about this.
Yeah.
His memory is no doubt a lot better than mine.
Who are the other attorneys practicing in Ketchikan?
At that time?
Yeah, at that time.
Well, they had a firm, Lester O'Gore was practicing by himself. And he is the father of Mrs. Nancy Murkowski. Not that Nancy was the only child. There was another sister who's very big in the U.S. Coast Guard, and a son who's still in Ketchikan, Robert Gore, Bob Gore.
Is he in a tournament, that's right?
Lester Gore?
Bob.
No, he's not. Judge Gore came to Ketchikan via the U.S. District Court out of Nome, and he had a very successful practice. He was a very wise attorney. And in the early days that I was there, Bob Jernberg and Lester Gore formed a partnership. And that was dissolved by Lester's death sometime after I got there. In 1948, let's see, there was Ziegler and King, which became Ziegler, King and Ziegler when I got there. Then there was another sole practitioner who recently has been very ill and who was the first president of the Alaska State Bar Association, first or second, W.C. Bill Stump. Mm-hmm. And Bill Stump and his half-brother, Ernie Bailey, mm-hmm. were the other partnership. And then other attorneys have come and gone over the years, but for durability, those people I've just named were...
What was Ketchikan's relationship to Juneau?
Well, sister cities, we always have been. Friendly rivals, I mean, but we didn't have very much to argue about. This was the seat of the territorial capital. And in those days, I believe Ketchikan was bigger than Juneau. And the people in Juneau and the people in Ketchikan rarely thought alike on any given issue.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, still do.
Was there competition among the lawyers?
No, because mostly I think you had in-city fights because it was a couple of days by steamer to get back and forth, and you had no planes, and you had excellent firms here in Juneau, the Robertson Montague and Eastoff firm and the Faulkner Banfield and Bootshever firm. They've been here forever and a day. And if there was competition, it would certainly have been respectful competition. Because you had top-rated lawyers in both towns.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit
with you. Sure.
Lester Gore, where was he from?
I don't know where the judge had his roots. All I knew is that he came to Ketchikan out of Nome, and I don't know whether a change in administration got him out of office or whether he just decided the grass was greener
mm-hmm.
in Southeastern. My father came to Alaska in 1913,
mm-hmm.
and he came here and formed, well, he clerked under Mr. Cheney. And this happened as a result. My father went to a business school in Baltimore and became one of the first male stenographers. And somehow he got out to Chicago, and depositions were brand new birds in those days. But he took, recorded, transcribed, whatever, a deposition which was taken in Chicago. And one of the lawyers was Mr. Cheney. I mean, John was so impressed with my father, he said, Zig, why don't you come back to Alaska with me and clerk for me, and then we'll work out some kind of a partnership, which is what Dad did.
Was Cheney originally from Alaska?
Cheney, I don't know where he came from, but he was here when my father got here, and my father came here at his instigation. This was 1913. Dad did clerk and passed. They formed a partnership, then World War I intervened, and after World War I, at the conclusion of which my father married my mother in 1919, and they decided they would strike out as part of the Cheney firm in Ketchikan, and then they decided that Zig might as well just start out for himself down there, which is what he did.
Mm-hmm. So Cheney stayed in Juneau?
Cheney stayed in Juneau, and for how long, I don't know, and I have no recollection of ever having met him, but I met his son,
uh-huh.
and He lives in Gig Harbor, Anacortes in Washington. And I believe he's a John Cheney too, but I know he's a Cheney. And a delightful guy. And he remembers about what I remember. He can remember his father talking about Zig, and I remember Zig talking about Mr. Cheney.
Mm-hmm. So when your father went to Ketchikan, did he immediately get into a partnership with
Water? Cheney? No, that came about, I believe, in the 30s sometime. He was a sole practitioner.
Was it difficult for him?
Oh, I don't think so. I think he did very well.
Was there any type of business that he represented mostly? Was it fishing?
Yeah, he represented some loggers, and then a lot of dumb rail work. And you'd have your leases, your contracts,
No criminal defense?
Though. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. That, too. Did a lot of insurance representation. Also, did a lot of plaintiff's work in negligence cases, depending upon who got there first.
Bill Arnold was in Ketchikan and...
That's right.
What?
That's right. And if you ask me when, I couldn't tell you. Probably the 20s. And another great lawyer, too, Judge Arnold is.
Was he ever associated with your father?
They were friends. They were friends. I don't think that they ever even shared office space. I'm sure they didn't.
I know that he did share office space with Lester Gore.
That would be right, because they were both closely affiliated with the salmon industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it would only be logical if they would have had a great deal in common.
Was Bill Arnold in Ketchikan at any time that you were there?
Not that I remember, and I don't think so. Unless he was dropping through, but never in active practice, no.
Did you have ties with him while you were practicing or in the legislature?
Well, we've talked on occasion, and I bump into Bill on those rare times when I get to Anchorage, or I'll see him at a cocktail party here or there.
Mm-hmm.
And twice in the last 5 years, I've run into Bill and Vivian, just happenstance, on a Washington Athletic Club bus going out to watch a Husky football game. Mm-hmm. I believe that was the last time that I saw the two of them, about 2 or 3 years ago.
Known for coordinating the lobby effort for the canned salmon
industry. Well, I don't know whether he still does.
No.
But for many years.
60.
Yeah, for many years he did.
Mm-hmm.
And truly a formidable foe. I'd much rather be on his side than against him.
Can you tell me anything about what it was like? What is lobbying?
Mm-mm. He never lobbied me, because he was out of it by the time I got in this game.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we move to back to when Dernburg and Gore, the 1940s and 50s in Ketchikan. Was there an organized bar in Ketchikan?
I told you the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. When I came back, Bob Dernburg was associated with a gentleman who's now deceased by the name of Ed Ginger. They were in partnership for, say, 3 to 5 years.
Uh-huh.
And then that partnership was dissolved, and then Judge Gore and Bob Dernburg formed their partnership, which lasted until Judge Gore died. And then Dernburg fell across some hard times, and for whatever reason, I wouldn't even guess, but he was affiliated at one time with Jerry Gucker, who is now semi-active, and he was affiliated with Robin Taylor, who is now the U.S., I'm not the U.S., but the District Court Magistrate in Wrangell and Petersburg. And you'd have to ask those people, or Dernburg, why those partnerships fell apart. And then Bob Dernburg ended up his last years of practice as a private practitioner.
What kind of cases did he handle?
Everything. He worked primarily in his last few years of active progress for the Alaska Loggers Association and for many of the individuals who comprise the association. In other words, this logging camp or that logging camp. And, and also, he and Lester Gore were instrumental in helping establish Ketchikan Pulp Company. That would be in the early 50s. That is, they went out and they purchased the land on which the mill now sits, and they've been counsel for the mill until they respectively, one died and the other retired. You're talking about roughly a 20 to 25 year period that that relationship has gone on.
Yeah.
Bob Dernberg, fine lawyer. Great guy, fine lawyer.
What was the Ketchikan bar like? The bar, was there an organized bar with functions?
Well, we had a Ketchikan Bar Association. And our idea of a function was to go out to somebody's cabin on a hot summer day and maybe have beer and pitch horseshoes or play bridge or whatever. If you mean to ever do anything even resembling being earth-shaking, the answer would be negative. The bar in Ketchikan today is a funny creature. Most of us gather every morning at 9 o'clock for a coffee. And to tell jokes, fireside. We just go in and we don't talk very much about cases. That's a verboten. You get fined $5 if you talk about something that's pending. And to talk politics. Now I got to quit for the day. I've got some things I have.